Yeah. Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast. In today's episode of the Soulcast, I'll be speaking with some folks about a new project slash book called Inhabit. Inhabit takes a look at what it means to live and fight in a world that is burning all around us. It sidesteps the radical identity and ideological labels and focuses on a set of liberatory practices for building a new world in the ruins of this one. While Silicon Valley types want to build fortresses for the wealthy, Inhabit imagines a world of autonomous territories sharing resources, skills, and power. You know, look around you, take stock, and find each other. I love this project. I love this book. If you're involved in activism or revolutionary organizing, I would suggest you and your friends get together, read this book, talk about it. You can read it online at inhabit.global, and you can request copies of the book there. And as usual, here's a plug for my Patreon. If you want to support the Soulcast, you can sign up at patreon.com/SOLEONE. Subscribers to the podcast get an exclusive song every month, exclusive podcasts, and most importantly, help me keep this place warm while I continue to keep up my schedule of putting out a podcast episode every 2 weeks. So to the peeps who've been supporting for the past year or 2 years, much love, thank you. And if you're thinking about it, just sign up for a dollar, it's all good. And before we get into this, I will play some trailers from some homies in the Channel Zero Podcast Network.
Hi, my name's Eamon Farrelly, and I have a podcast. How original, right? It's called Radical People, and it's about radical people. Basically, I sit down and I interview people who I find very interesting. Interesting why? Interesting because they took a look at the world around them, saw a need, saw a problem perhaps, and they decided to address that need or fix that problem. How? With direct action. That's right, not by begging the dirty government and its politicians and bureaucrats, and not by lobbying corporations to please, please, please stop being so awful. No, they get together with some comrades or some homies or just whoever, and they implement whatever solution they see fit, however they see fit to do it. So, that's my podcast. I listen to these people's stories, which turn out to be sometimes very funny, sometimes very scary, sometimes harrowing, always edifying, sometimes titillating. Actually, I haven't had one yet that's been titillating. I know, like, making things a little sexed up generally sells, but typically when people are, those are ISIS soldiers, it doesn't get as sexy as you think. Or maybe it does, and they just haven't told me that part yet. So anyway, you should listen to my podcast if you just happen to be really bored, or on a road trip, or you just need to drown out what's going on around you. Check out Radical People by searching for it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or by checking out the Channel Zero Network. So yeah, that's my commercial for my show. Thank you for listening to my commercial for my show.
And when we die, we will die with our hearts unbound.
Anarchism, a social philosophy which aims at the emancipation, economic, social, political, and spiritual of the human race.
Anarchism is not bombs, disorder, or chaos. It is not robbery or murder. It is not a war of each against all.
Anarchism is the very opposite of all that. Find out for yourself. Tune into Subversion 1312.
Live, Tuesdays 9 to 10pm.
On 4ZZZ 102.1 FM or streaming 4ZZZ.org.au.
Podcasts and related content available at subversion1312.org.
And channelzeronetwork.com.
Conclusion?
We stand for anarchy, anti-capitalism, anti-racism, anti-authoritarianism, internationalism,
autonomy, direct democracy, ecology, self-organization, solidarity, anti-fascism, anti-neoliberalism,
anti-nationalism, atheism, equality, and freedom.
Hey, what up? How y'all doing today?
Good, how are you?
Good.
I'm great. I'm great. It's winter here, but it's only fall everywhere else, so that's great. So we're here to talk about this new project, Inhabit. Let's just get into it. Let's talk about it.
So, great. Sounds good. Where should we start?
I don't know. I've read the book like 3 or 4 times. I really love it. Like this project in particular, it's like near and dear to me because it just fuses just so many things that are critical ways of thinking about like what it means to engage in. I don't even know if the word is revolutionary, but it really it makes a break. You know, it makes a break for a new way of thinking about. I mean, it's like struggle isn't really even the word. So I guess, yeah, let's just start from the beginning. How would you describe this project?
Yes, I think just at the most basic level, what we're working on here is a sort of collective anonymous piece of strategy, something that's based where we are, but also generalizes more broadly. And so this is something that is in some ways a project coming out of North America, out of the U.S. and Canada, that's trying to respond to the gaps that the state leaves us and respond to climate change and start from the problems of our time and work from there to have this sort of sense of what it looks like to organize in light of those problems, in light of the problems of our epoch. Yeah, so you mentioned the book, and it's part of Inhabit is instructions for autonomy. It's, you know, the little orange book that's super easy to read and just like tiny. So it's like an intimate object, but it's also this like network of right now what feels maybe like 15 or so territories and producing here. And there's also the website and pretty soon here a newsletter that'll be a way for people both to anonymously and collectively share tools for, like Camille said, addressing problems of our time.
So these like autonomous areas across these places in the United States, for instance, are any of these like public? Can people go visit them?
Yeah, definitely. I think like in the part of Manhattan is that there's no inside outside. You know, it's definitely like a way to try and communicate with people. They're like, hey, I read this book or I've never read this book, but I feel like it's important in this Anthropocene to like to find each other and start to learn to build and fight. I don't think that like inclusion and exclusion is a part of the project at all. Yeah, so in that way maybe it's also more difficult to find the people who are working on projects in autonomy because we're not working with a direct ZOD equivalent in the States. We're not working with that piece of territory, you know, Chiapas in the United States and Canada as much. But then this is another tool for when those projects do exist, you know, in a big urban center, in a rural area, in a more suburban area, how do we find each other and what is the sort of basis for communicating what we're trying to do more broadly? And precisely so that you're not building a sort of interior and exterior, but you have a project which is very densely connected people doing a wide breadth of projects that all have this orientation around solving major issues in autonomy or addressing them or building on their bases.
Right. That's one of the things that I really like that I've noticed through the Instagram and just through the text is that like, you know, it just showed, like, there was one photo that I saw that was just, like, hanging out at the local diner. And then it just, like, you know, posts to, like, you know, some dude who may or may not have been a Trump supporter or, you know, you don't know, a farmer or a butcher. And just this idea of sort of breaking out of radical subculture in some ways, in just like evaluating your immediate surroundings and trying to, like, I don't know if integrate is the word, but to try to pull together the resources that are around you, you know?
I mean, totally. One thing with a lot, or like that Inhabit is trying to do, is instead of being oriented around like a singular understanding of like capitalism or oppression, or the state, like you were saying, with it's all of the people at a diner, like based on various different like ideological presets, could still come together and think critically about like how we're going to engage climate change, how we're going to start to live honestly, how we're going to break down these social relations that are really causing, like, that are causing us to feel separated from one another on an economic basis, on an ecological level, and on an existential level.
Right. I mean, like, I've said this on like a podcast earlier, but I'll say it again, because I just moved to Maine and bought like a little homestead. And when I moved here, I was reading this book, and like within a week of getting here, you know, my neighbor came over with, you know, bags of tomatoes and kale, and like, you know, he's probably, you know, he works at the Navy Yard building ships, and you know, I don't know who he voted for. I didn't ask, but he brought me all these vegetables, you know, and then started bringing us eggs. And you know, like through my conversations with him, he's, you know, it's like, yeah, I get 25 pounds of maple syrup right outside of your house. And, I love the idea of, you know, learning just like, if you just open your eyes, you know, it's like having a decoder ring or whatever. If you just open your eyes and look around, you never know what you can learn and what the potentialities are, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And like really similar to that, in the Midwest, there's a medium-sized like city where there's a large-scale tree planting. There are a few cities. I'm thinking about one in specific. But yeah, you're 100% right. There's like several cities throughout the Midwest that have really amazing tree planting projects. And the one specifically that I'm thinking about is All Black autonomous organization that is oriented around education, and they've gotten like a ton of, I want to say hundreds of fruit trees, and they're planting urban fruit orchards, fruit and nuts, and teaching people of all generations like about the trees, about urban permaculture. And it's the same sort of situation where it's just like now there's a fruit orchard in the middle of this otherwise like metropolitan area. And so now people can like walk down the street and often be like, oh, here's some free food. And also I understand how that was grown and I can do that myself.
That's incredible. Maybe you can give me their contact info after this call.
Yeah. That sounds. Yeah, for sure. Sure.
Yeah, there are some people in Maine who are really big on like rewilding urban spaces, which is fascinating to me. So like another like, I don't know, whatever theoretical move or whatever I kind of wanted to talk about was, are you familiar with Walter Benjamin? Have y'all read?
Yeah.
So years ago, I went to this critical theory seminar, and they were talking about his ideas around exodus and how, like, instead of resisting and fighting, like, what if the revolutionary moment, you know, looked like a shedding of the state, a shedding of state power and capitalism. And like, it always haunted me because it just sounded like bullshit. You know, but it also made some sense to me, you know, but it's like haunted me for years. And so, you know, I've visited some of these autonomous villages in France or whatever. And when I saw that, it kind of clicked in my head, like, oh, wait, you can still have like a, you can still engage in struggle and, you know, this a revolutionary movement, but also live in a different way. And so I guess I was just curious, like, you know, a lot of times people talk about revolution, or like I've described my own politics as revolutionary, but I've wanted to stop doing that because I don't, like, we've seen how all these revolutions have ended. I guess I just wanted you to sort of talk about like that idea of like revolution versus like prefiguration and exodus.
Yeah. Well, I think like any revolution historically has included mass defection. And I think what Inhabit is talking about means fleeing with the tools. So taking all of those things that you've learned through your vocation or things that you've learned from your life and, you know, putting one foot in front of the other, you know, turning your back. Yeah, exactly. The idea being that, like, if enough of us do it more and understand, like, our orientation towards one another and start to connect and find ways of living together, it'll be more and more possible for more and more people to desert this world.
Yeah, one of the phrases I heard in the IGD interview that some folks talking about this said is pushing capitalism to the margins of our life.
Yeah. And at a certain point, all of these like powers that be that move us in these various ways, if we are able to like learn to move autonomously and collectively, I think like the first step is always a dual process. The first step of that is like identifying where the gaps are, so being like critical of our environment and what is shaping it, and like what the interests are of like various like power flows, and identifying like where those gaps are, because we're not in control of like our own survival at this point. And so how do we edge capital out? How do we edge the state out so that we can finally have like both autonomous and collective control over both like our own survival and our own destiny?
Yeah, and in a way that makes it so that it's possible to even fight against the state as a powerful entity sustainably, just knowing that that's like that's both, you know, a moment, a series of moments, a process, and a constant fight. And so the sort of building part of Inhabit, the part that's saying, you know, we need scientists, we need engineers, we need people who know permaculture, we need to actually be creating a world that's also ingrained in and sort of like as part of it as much as anything else is the ability to fight and the ability and the desire to fight against the state and capital.
Right.
And I think that's the revolutionary potential in it.
Right. I mean, because if you look at, you know, if you look at other places in the world where you have these autonomous territories, like in Mexico, for instance, you know, large swaths of the population, you know, collaborate in resistance. It's not just like 13 diehard people from out of town.
Yeah, we need as many people as possible. And like, and there's no time like other than a year now. Like that's one of the this epoch path. Like regardless of when you start identifying the beginning of the Anthropocene, like it's been culminating to this moment where we should have done something all along, but now that we're here, there's a different kind of urgency.
And the idea within habit is that that sense that we're coming to the end and therefore necessarily a beginning will make sense to people, and that we'll have that in common.
Yeah, and the sort of sense of apocalypse or ending that necessarily means that, like, in the opening something will form, and we can watch, you know, we can sit back and watch as the alt-right uses that opening as any number of really terrible groups or ideologies, et cetera, seek power, and just understand that that power will be up for grabs, and power is up for grabs now in these gaps as they're forming. So, like, cracks and rock or something, things will start to grow and start to fill in. And so habit is also about becoming powerful. It's about building towards these series of moments where we want to survive, we're determined to survive, we're determined to survive with each other, and to create and find the tools necessary to do that.
Yeah, of course. Right on. So it recently came out that I don't necessarily have the right dates here, but basically that we're fucked. You know, by 2040, the temperature could be increased by 3 or 7. And by the end of the century, you know, originally, you know, like 5 years ago, those predictions were like up to 5 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. And now some people are saying, oh no, it could be 10, could be 20, could be 50, you know? So I'm just wondering, like, you know, in hearing all this news, and y'all mentioned the Anthropocene a couple times. How does the, you know, the climate, catastrophe, you know, inform your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think on one hand, it's just so easy to imagine this future where the most wealthy people have this sort of fortresses of survival that keep people out, that sort of, like, are afraid of the outside other, the exterior, and survival is this thing which is totally, you know, monopolized, for lack of a better word, by a wealthy and powerful, you know, few, sort of, like, relatively few people who are not trying to ensure anybody else's survival. And I think that's almost too easy to imagine. I mean, I'm thinking to a news story, I think maybe in the New York Times not too long ago, where the scientist was called to speak with a bunch of very wealthy people about this, about climate change, et cetera. Basically, the conversation that they had was them asking him, when shit goes down, how do we make sure that, you know, poor people, marginalized people, other people who want to survive, don't take our stuff, don't take our means of survival? And this is a very real conversation that's happening, you know, among, like, you know, particular, so, like, corporate or, like, wealthy people right now. Like, there's a sense of urgency or apocalypse. And so knowing that that's, like, that's on the table, it's on the table that survival is sort of limited, or I guess Kennedy was saying, like, we don't have the tools for our survival right now. That influences us or guides us to know, or to stumble over my words a little bit, that pushes us to consider, okay, what would it look like to have the tools so that we are not rendered sort of outside even the possibility of survival, and so that it's not so concentrated and is actually available and is something that we can work towards collectively.
Yeah, I mean, we inhabit kind of, like, the text positions itself at, like, the nexus of apocalyptic catastrophe and revolutionary potential. And I think, like, the thing that the UN report being the most honest document that we have thus far of documenting climate change, it's a question of scale, and it means that the human geological force is on the level of a meteorite. A meteorite crashing into the Earth is what created the last epoch, and now the one that we are in was created by humans. That means that's how big we are. And so that means that is how big our response has to be. Otherwise, it's going to continue to be this capitalist theme, just another like word to describe the age that we've entered. And so, like, that has to inform our thinking. Like, just to go back to what Camille was saying, that climate negotiators have been for years saying very clearly that 2 degrees Celsius increase means, because like how Earth systems work is not going to be like a uniform global rise. 2 degrees in like the United States, for example, means 4 to 5 degrees in other places. Back in 2009, a climate negotiator from one of the countries in Africa pointed out, like, 2 degrees of increase means that Africa will burn, and this is a climate genocide. And so, like, understanding, like, that those stakes are on the table is exactly what you pointed to, that, like, we, people are already, the power of we are already understanding survival is limited and are hedging their own bets. So, like, this is our final moment to, like, intercede. Obviously, we're always going to be on, like, the side of as many people as possible. So we're not interested in, like, anything short of all of us.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is one of my questions for later, but since we touched on it, yeah, I went down a YouTube wormhole a while ago about New Zealand, and it seems like a lot of Silicon, like, apparently it's become like code in Silicon Valley, like, hey, did you buy any land in New Zealand yet? Because there's like an empty island in New Zealand where I think it was Jeff Bezos or one of these people had bought up like 100 square miles and a lake, and like, you know, you can just imagine them literally fleeing to New Zealand with their mercenary forces and just
pulling up.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Dark. Very dark. Yeah. That's something that I've heard about a few times now, and it's these sort of corporate heads, a number of politicians. So I know a lot of people out of Silicon Valley who have something of the sort of the urgency of it all, but can't even imagine anything other than their own survival. Like, that already seems so, like, so huge for them. And, you know, that's not to say, and this is something that I think is worth touching on, that's not to say that there's not a defection from that possible as well, right? Like, we can look at Silicon Valley and the technical skills there. We can look at any place where the tech world is taking root and imagine ways that there are things that we could use, we could learn, there are tools there that we could fight with. But that's a particular, a particularly dark path to be on, as one bound for New Zealand on your own, private plane or part of the island or something, to detect from that for any individual, for people, would be such a huge move towards the possibility of somebody's survival other than one's family. Right.
Yeah, it's fucking crazy. I just keep thinking, like, you know, is some magical thing gonna happen to just, I don't know, like, you know, to treat this as if it's like a World War II mobilization, because it really is like that. And you see the opposite happening. And even, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into electoral politics, but like, none of the politicians are talking about this. Like, when you, like, we're in, like, there's an election coming up, and I don't think I've heard, I mean, I haven't been following it that closely, but the headlines are not about the fact that the world is about to burn. Like, that's not what we're talking about in the United States.
I think it's really hard. I think it's existentially difficult to reckon with one's end. Like, and so what Inhabit is trying to do is position this as our beginning, as a way
that people can start to rewrite the narrative that we've been learning for so long. Because we want people to feel empowered to look at what's going on and be like, not for me. I'm going to figure out how to do something else while also staying connected to the world. You know, deserting doesn't mean like leaving behind your family who wants to talk about electoral politics. You know, and also like Inhabit is radically open to all possibilities. Like, so if someone wants to go homestead and that's what their like their point from like building capacity looks like, excellent. If someone wants to start an urban free medical clinic, excellent. If someone wants to do disaster relief, excellent. It can look like all of these different things, and it doesn't have to like look along any one like media narrative.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. Well, so like I feel like I trace the origin, at least for me, like I've been following various projects out of New York for a while. Specifically the sort of project surrounding 1882 Woodbine, which is a place where, you know, that it always just like I said, the ideas in this are really near and dear to me because I love food. I'd notice like on one day, you know, at 1882 Woodbine, they'd be bringing in Kurdish revolutionaries to talk about what was happening over there. Then the next day they'd have a seminar on how to do lacto fermentation. And so I just love, projects like that. And so I was just wondering if you can talk about, you know, what, like, can you talk about some of the quote unquote, like organizing approaches yeah. that you're talking about here, AKA, you know, developing hubs.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think obviously this will look different everywhere, right? And that's one of the things that we're hoping sort of like, comes out and have it is that there's a strategy which can be common, but when you show up in, you know, let's say like New York City or you know, El Paso, Texas, or anywhere in the Bay, or somewhere in, you know, like in Montreal, for example, what that means will look really different based on who's around you, because it is very much about finding each other. But I think the project of Inhabit is deeply inspired by sort of maker spaces, hacker spaces, DIY permaculture, medicine, disaster relief. And so just sort of heeding the call of, you know, some combination of our interests, our capacities, what's around us, in order to find each other and just taking this question very seriously. What does it mean to do any of the things that I'm doing, that my friends are doing, and organizing around that. And just for example, the sort of organization we've seen around Hurricane Harvey in Houston is a response to an immediate problem. It's many people moving collectively to provide supplies, to gather funds, to do rescue, to provide basic medicine. This sort of thing just allows us to find each other through sort of natural or like I mean, literally through a natural disaster, but also through just the problems or the situation that we're embedded in. And that's a lot of people in Houston organizing, outside of Houston organizing, people from that entire sort of like area or region coming together around the common problem and being committed to solving it themselves. And maybe if there's not that sort of immediate disaster facing us, it is a little bit more looking around us and also looking in a little bit, saying, okay, you know, where are the places where there is potential, what are the resources that are available or could be made available to start addressing something like food or tech autonomy or, you know, any of these things.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're touching on moving to, like, ex-urban, suburban, and urban centers that aren't facing, like, immediate natural disasters, are still looking for the same things. We're still looking to, like, what are basic needs? How are we going to figure out food logistics? How are we going to figure out energy logistics?
Communication,
like, how are we going to continue to reproduce our lives in a way that is, like, joyful? Like, we don't want to live in squalor. A lot of us have been doing that for a long time.
And not everybody wants to farm.
Yeah, right. Like, exactly. And so, like, on the non-disaster-related side, the things that we're seeing, like, in these, like, broad autonomous networks are locations that are reimagining schools, and so that are doing intensive workshops and trainings on crafts and homesteading and skills that are, like, embedded in a specific location, but they're using, like, a space that makes, like, coming to it and leaving, so, like, some sort of, like, transient possible. And we're also seeing a lot of people get involved with opioid recovery services that are both, like, mobile and residential. So in one city in the Midwest, how they responded to, like, a Trump rally recently was doing a free naloxone training and distribution.
A what training and distribution?
Naloxone, which is a medication designed for rapid opioid overdose recovery. So it's like what you give someone if they're about to die from an opioid overdose. And it should just be, like, widely available on every street corner. But it's not. And so, like, there was a way at that rally to try and, like, connect with people on this, like, other side about, like, no, here's something that we can all agree on, right? That like, everyone should have, like, access to clean needles, naloxone, and a sober living environment. And so not only are they doing that, like, at the rally, but they're also doing that work in their cities, in their communities, in their neighborhoods. And then, like, so providing, like, peer, or not providing, but, like, working on peer-run sober living communities. I always get caught, I'm sorry, I just, like, check myself. I always get caught in this, like, service provider language, and it's so hard to unlearn that and realize that, like, no, it's not that I'm, like, charity or, like, providing a service. This is, like, a huge need in my community, and I'm, like, fundamentally changed by this experience, and I'm participating in the ways that I want to see things get better. I'm growing as a person. This is, like, very much so about me, because it's very much about everyone else who I care about. And it's really hard to, like, sum that up into one word. But participation works relatively well. But I always, like, oh, sorry for that. I slipped or something. But, you know, there's, like, other examples. There's, like, free food distribution, helping people, doing, like, cooking classes so that people learn how to, like, cook meals for themselves. Also, like, making meals on a large scale so that people don't have to cook, and so that they can come just, like, enjoy time together.
Yeah, and all of these things have all of these sort of projects and ways that we see possibilities for people to, you know, plug in sort of in the spirit of a habit or in a way of, like, finding each other. A lot of these have a way of just cutting through, like, sort of differences that people imagine or, like, see, you know, politically or otherwise, sort of, like, social barriers that we experience between each other. So the naloxone training, for example, by presenting the problem, which people in that town feel and see maybe every day, you know, maybe more often, maybe less often than that, there's a way of just, like, polarizing in the best kind of way. Like, if somebody can stand there and say, no, this isn't important, you know, people, these obviously aren't my words, but, like, you know, people deserve to die or something, that polarizes against, you know, between the people who are empathic and can feel, you know, the humanity of another person and are committed to responding to it, which is fundamentally what this question of survival is. It's, like, survival for all of us. And the people who are literally just, you know, no, I'm not in it for anyone. I'm not in it for anyone else. And, you know, in a similar way with the sort of tree planting projects that are planting perennials, is cutting through this problem of food autonomy and saying, look, this tree is by the sidewalk. It has persimmons or plums or apples or pawpaws growing from it. Take those freely. This is for everyone. It doesn't even make sense to have your own fruit tree necessarily. Right. And then it's like, because it's polarizing and because it doesn't make sense to only have one fruit tree, this is all like capacity, both for like living together, but it's also capacity for fighting. And that's something else that like, those two things, building fighting, like act in the world that we live in, like actually can't be separated from one another. And that's another like point that I think that Inhabit works really well with. So as much as there are these autonomous food products that are related to Inhabit, there's also autonomous gyms and self-defense classes and learning how to fight, because there are a lot of people who have to deal with interpersonal violence on a regular basis, and that's a symptom of these economic and like forces, these economic and social forces that be. And there are also like bookstore collectives that people can stake out their own position, think critically about the world that they live in, and develop strategies for fighting.
Yeah, that's, I mean, all that is awesome. Mail me some, tell those people to mail me some fucking pawpaws. Shit. I brought my pawpaw tree from, I had two, I brought it to Maine because I was like, oh, it's more humid, they'll be happier, and I think it's fucking dead, so I'm just start over.
Yeah.
So one of the things you were saying that I thought was interesting, and it reminds me of, I don't know, I always think of Scott Crow, who's like, kill the activist in your head. And it's this idea that like we are, that like we have to go around saving people and we have to constantly be self-sacrificing, and just how fucking unhealthy that is for social movements. You burn out that way. And also everything is abstract. You're not actually like materially meeting any of your own needs. And so how are you going to help anyone else? And what are you fighting for? You know?
Yeah. Right.
So, okay, we talked about a whole bunch of things, along those levels. Are there any other skills other than like, you know, hacking and growing food and self-defense that you think are important moving into the future, or, you know, things that you're geeking out on right now?
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of the breadth of skills that we're talking about, we have a whole world to build. We actually literally have a whole world to build. So, you know, doctors and nurses have obviously extremely valuable skills. Woodworkers, people who can plant. Carpenters, we need artists. We need a poetry for the new world that we're building. We need music for the world that we're building. Almost anything that's generative and has a sort of like strategic or communal element to it, in some form will need and welcome. I think of the breadth that way. We have so much with much to do, and really like all of these skills are very pertinent. Yeah, it's really anything that anyone wants to do. But I think like we're building a new world. This is like a utopia, and it's here and it's right now. And that means we're not just replacing the old world. We're not trying to, when we say like we're filling it, before we were talking about how part of like, this process of world building is like critiquing the world that we're in and identifying like the gaps that it leaves, and looking at how we can autonomously fill that. And like those gaps exist for a reason. And so like I guess like and have it was like designed and written in a very specific way. And part of that, like its poetic elements, are because like poetry is an operation in language, that deactivates something in language. Like it turns it on its head. And that is like those tools that like take what you're doing, the activity that you're doing, and allow it like make it inoperative for a minute, so that you can see these other uses that what you're doing has. That's what we want. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what we want to see more of. When you make a thing and then you play with it, and like through that playing with it, new uses become possible.
Yeah, that's one of
I was just going to say, just as a specific example of something that we've seen before and we, at the very least, will need to see again, especially in the States, is like, you know, things that have that operate in the tradition of the Jain Collective, right, where it's like these people who are motivated to be able to perform their own safe and sort of intimate and respectful abortions for other people. And that's something, you know, there's been an increase in the number of, like, DIY gynecology seminars that I and others have seen popping up, either at large conferences or in more, like, intimate personal settings with people we know. And this is very much, like, to all of the OBGYNs or doctors out there who are doing this day-to-day, like, this is something that can be turned on its head, and it can be turned on its head to the benefit of everyone. And, of course, that's true for almost any technical skill or craft.
Is trying to do is like expand the radical imagination, you know, like let's embrace the hacker ethic. Because to me, like permaculture is something I'm very interested in, but it's hacking, you know, it's hacking. And like the stuff about like drones and, you know, because so many groups are, you know, technology is bad or technology is a tool and we have to keep it at bay. Whereas I feel like what the book in Habit is saying is like, everything's up for grabs, you know, just kill all those cops in your head and just think way outside the box. So,
yeah, I think that's spot on.
All right. Well, here's a question. How does the left bark without teeth? That's one of the things that jumped out to me in the book. And so I was just curious, like, you know, when we talk about building this, you know, new world, like how, like right now, like how does the left bark without teeth?
It's more so just like looking at, I think it's like coming from a place of insecurity. I think it's saying like, the world, like you were talking about before, like the world is going to shit, right? And no one's talking about it. Like no one is logistically, metaphysically, economically dealing with like the real like mass, the weight of our epoch. And so I guess it's just like a way to say like, that what they're offering isn't dignified because it doesn't feel like a response to scale. It's not proportional to the problem. You know, even if there's like some discussion or discourse around climate change, the minute that is sort of funneled into, you know, any variety of you know, petitions or electoral pathways, it becomes disproportionate to the actual problem. The solution becomes untenable in the sense that it just cannot address the reality. Yeah, and it's not necessarily like it's not staking like any particular ideological claim against the left, but it's more so like calling people to those are things to make our answers proportionate to the problem.
Right on, right on. Well, what about, so like in, you know, a lot of people reference Rojava and the works of Murray Bookchin, which is like, you know, these autonomous ideas, they're rooted in anti-state power and also employ the idea of municipal federalism, which is, people are actually trying this out, like in the Pacific Northwest, you have like, you know, anarchists running for ombudsman or, you know, city council in random cities or whatever, you know, but under the banner of Murray Bookchin. And so I'm just wondering how, when you're thinking about these projects, like how do you imagine the relationship between like local state bureaucracies and state power in general in relation to these projects?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first important thing is to just remember that the state, the American Empire, is already in decline. So to the extent that that's a channel that people are using, there's this element of like jumping into this like machines breaking or this organism that's already decaying. But that said, the sort of sentiment of inhabit is open to sort of the full breadth of possibility. And so it's conceivable that there's a time and place where it is strategic to engage with, you know, the city council or the mayor. There are actually just many cases where in response to certain questions or for articulable intentional reasons, that makes sense.
Like to say before. That would be good.
Like to say before.
Yeah. If a city council person could save a forest and make sense to either like run for city council to do that or to like support the person who's doing that. Yeah.
But yeah.
If that's the need is to save this forest, or like this is the fastest, this is the most effective way save that forest. That
might be fun. Yeah, and this answering that question just has to be grounded in the full reality of it. Like, if that actually organizing other people, organizing like many other people, and having a campaign sort of like the Nizad campaign or the, you know, any of these fair no sorry no airport campaign Nizad was sort of born out of. If organizing people is another option, it means that we come out of it with more dense connections and people who are sort of like polarized in their territories, then that seems like a better option. But it's just weighing these very realistically and with an eye for, you know, following through with the commitment to render the state inoperative and to not become entangled in a way that means that, you know, our comrades are in charge of the police somehow, or, you know, are like to compromise themselves or anyone else. And it's really like, it's not, we have to like get past these ideological biases. So it's not a matter of like the state in the U.S. is something to be avoided. Like, you can't make a statement like that. But it doesn't make sense. What is actually happening is the state is in control of like the police and the military. And like the military, maybe there's like some tension between like the state and the military. And one of the reasons why it might be not a great idea to run a mayoral candidate is because that mayoral candidate is going to be in charge of funding the police. And they may not have like the political capacity necessary to defund the police. And that's when you're going to run into a circumstance, like the one that Camille just described, where you're actually, or someone who you thought was like a comrade or a friend is now running the police force. And so like you have to like, when you think strategically, you have to identify what the factors are when you're in addressing the problem that you're trying to solve, and like, and weigh them and be realistic about them instead of being ideological. And so I guess like that's like the question with any sort of like municipal project is like, can I like what you were saying, like, can I articulate the problem? How do I weigh the risks and the benefits? And am I going to
become a state agent in this process, and how is that going to transform me?
Right. And I feel like the word here, it's a word used in the book, but it's a word that I think is like an important way of sort of wrestling this idea out, is this word destituent or destituent power. Can you speak on this concept and what it means?
Yes.
Or do you agree? Do you feel like it's not important, or is it like,
it's super important. Hella important. You're 100% right. we were just having a moment of like, you know, this is in some ways a huge sort of theoretical like basis for what a lot of these projects do, whether they're producing any kind of theory themselves. Like, you know, every needle exchange that's offering naloxone and clean needles is finding a gap, you know, finding this thing that's like the state, you know, cannot or is not addressing, right? And then kind of jumping into that gap and then putting your arms out, just pushing that gap further and further open until you have this entire like process and all these resources that can address the thing which the state cannot touch or cannot touch effectively or can't touch according to people's needs. And just again to reiterate the DIY gynecology thing, it's this other instance, which I, you know, this is kind of the visual I have associated with destituent power. It's just like finding this gap, jumping in with all of the resources and comrades you can find, and just pushing that gap open, right? And you're just totally rendering anything the state can try to do in that sort of plane of you know, strategy or resources, et cetera. You're just rendering it inoperative. You're making it totally irrelevant. Yeah, and so I have this visual for constituent power, which is based on a lot of these concepts. But maybe, I can add more to that.
I think it's super helpful to contrast destitution with constitution. It's like, because like, destitution is like a negative, whereas constitution is a positive, and generally it's just like easier to do what you were doing like visually and like really trying to summon something concrete with a positive. So we're contrasting this. Constituent power is like how people like govern and manage and relate to one another now. It's through like these institutions and constitutions. And it means that our problem, any like problem solving done through this constituent power would be solved by putting the right people in existing institutions. And so, like, destitutive power or, like, destitution is about finding and expanding and filling in our own term, on our own terms, like, the gaps in the state power and, like, rendering state activity inoperative, meaning that, like, the work it's doing isn't useful to us anymore. So, like you said before, like, pushing it to the margins, you know, and it's, like, there are lots of different ways that we understand our relationships to one another, but for the most part, we live like in a world engulfed by the commodification of like people and things, and we face like this rapid acceleration of that economy, and like, it's ravaging our living environment. And so it's urgent to explore new forms of life and creating those through new activities, new ways of understanding ourselves, new ways to exist in community. And like that's a big part of like what destitutive power is so that we improvise with a specific purpose and make something, play with it, and expose new uses in it. And the power part definitely comes in from sharing like these new, like, these like new modes of existence.
Yeah, I just love I love thinking about that concept. I remember we were doing a reading group years ago, and someone was just like destitute power. Like, what the fuck does that mean? And we just sat there
thinking
about it for 45 minutes. I feel like we touched on most of like the basic concepts of inhabit. Now, I don't know, is there Is there anything, you know, from the questions that I sent earlier that we haven't touched on that you feel like you had a real good response to and you wanted to talk about, or things or things that we things that we may have like not gone into depth about the actual work of Inhabit?
So, I mean, there was one question that you asked that I just think is one that it's both difficult to answer and one that I imagine like lots of people being in habit wonder and trying to like place it. And it's a question of sort of like, what is the relationship of inhabit to specific tendencies that especially have this identity component to them? So for example, like, you know, being an anarchist, being a communist, being a socialist. And, you know, one thing that we were talking about and thinking about this question is, what does it mean, right, to encounter somebody and that's the axis along which you relate? And so it says, you know, I'm a communist, I'm an anarchist, I'm a socialist. And I think right now, maybe more than ever before in the U.S. in particular, it's hard to place any meaning on, you know, an identity that somebody's giving you in terms of like a political tendency or ideology of some kind. So when somebody comes up to me or anyone else and says, I'm an anarchist, I'm a communist, we can't really identify what strategy is there. We don't have a sort of like heuristic for what that means anymore. So something in habit has to do rather than positioning itself, you know, along an axis that has quickly available heuristics and meanings about its strategy, is that we have to address the sort of like void of meaning, the sort of lack of any word to encompass revolutionary strategy right now. And we don't have to take any shortcuts or utilize any heuristics, like saying we're anarchists or communists or socialists, that tell other people what our strategy is. Like, we actually have to start from saying exactly what we mean. This question of finding each other and establishing hubs and being, you know, built this sort of like building and fighting framework. We have to state like exactly what's possible and what we want, and then allow other people to distill back into the kind of like heuristics of being able to recognize projects that have that potential. And I think that's an important thing to address, because it's very like common to want to be able to place something in any of these identities or worlds. And so having something that won't proclaim itself, that can only be like read and distilled in that direction, kind of like allows and have it to cut through all of these identities and sort of like packaged, you know, maybe strategies, maybe positions.
Inhabit could be like a bridge between those various tendencies, because it is like necessarily heterogeneous. Like, the hope is that there's some way through inhabit, whether it's like through sharing the book, whether it's through the website, or through like the newsletter, it's going to be launched a way to like share stories like from one territory like to another, and show that you can like find what's in common, and that way the tools aren't going to be necessarily linked to one specific position or like one specific ideology, but instead we can like pick a tool up and like see how it's appropriate in one setting and how it looks totally different. It can be used totally differently, but also really effectively in another setting. And I feel like when you have relationships that are first predicated on these like identities or these tendencies, it obfuscates how you can use the tools, the position that other person is offering you. And so like, yeah, inhabit is a way to like kind of like set that stuff aside and instead like communicate with one another on a more strategic basis, but still like with this utopian and autonomous and collective future that we're all like moving towards together in mind.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I've been really deeply sort of entrenched in anarchist communities over the, I don't know, past decade, probably not that long, but, and when I went to like all these permaculture things, I was like, God, all these people are comrades. Like we could all, like these people are awesome. Like where have these people been? Like, oh my God. And it just like cracked my head open. And so the thing you were talking about, like sharing stories and things like that, I feel like, so if people like this conversation, they like your project or what, you know, if they're interested in this and they want to do like read, like I just found out a bunch of my homies did a reading group in Denver on this and they were, I was just talking with them about it before doing the interview.
Oh, cool.
And so like what, like if people are going to, you know, talk about the book, and get together and do it. You know, what do you think would be some meaningful, you know, strategies for those conversations? You were saying like, you know, look at, you know, yeah. What would be some meaningful ways for people to think about this stuff as they're like, you know, they all get together and read the book and then what?
Yeah, I mean, I think if as people are reading the book and they're specifically applying what they're reading and feeling like some sort of resonance with the way that they're living, if they could start to identify the tools that they're using and write about what the tool is, how they're using it, what and like what problems that they're solving with it, like and their relationship to the tool, that'd be super helpful because they can share that. They can write a narrative around it that's like their own and that's like autonomous and hopefully through the Inhabit network, like share it anonymously.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, and then just reading Inhabit in context of what sort of like struggles are happening in a particular territory or area and just being, you know, like allowing this relationship to form between like whatever strategy you're coming into it with, the text and the actual problem, like what would it mean to organize on the basis of, you know, increased funding in a particular place, the sort of like collapse of any, you know, social welfare mechanisms that are there, any kind of pipeline that's cutting through any of these like infrastructure projects that are actually to everybody's detriment. Yeah, people should start met, like coming up with positive concepts of revolution. Like, what do they think that these next 2 years are going to look like? Acknowledging both like the catastrophe, but also our revolutionary potential, and write our own future.
And think big.
Yeah.
Think big. Have a little imagination and beauty to it.
Yeah.
All right. Well.
And poetry.
Yeah. I might know some poets. So, all right. Well, I guess that pretty much, I mean, I have like millions of questions, but I feel like we pretty much touched on all the stuff that I thought was important. So at the end of every interview, I like to, ask people like how they can get in touch or how they can like, you know, support the work. And, if you recommend any books, any, if people enjoyed this text, if there's other things that people should be geeking out on.
Yeah. So in terms of getting in touch and also just having the text of Inhabit, people can go to inhabit.global. So that's inhabit.global, global. And that has the full text of Inhabit. Also, on the back page, the very back or last page of the book, the back of the last page, sorry. There's an email address for a distribution inquiry. So if you can think of a place where 10, 20, 100 copies of Inhabit could go and people would enjoy them there and read them, then you can email hello@inhabit.global to inquire about distribution. Yeah, I think in terms of reaching out, contacting, you know, us for distribution or with any questions about getting the book.
Awesome. And any Are there any other texts that you want to throw out there that you think people should read? You can't say the Communist Manifesto.
No, pretty long. I think Camus got a few. I was just looking.
We wrote a list.
You see? Yeah, go ahead. Okay, so a few that we sort of collectively came up with, just in terms of thinking about cybernetic stress strategies and the sort of tech dystopia that we're facing. Just looking at something like Google's new digital age document is kind of incredible because it actually just captures that of obviously like not written from our comments. The text, "This is not a program," is another one that we thought of. And then a few people suggested Normcore Thesis by Cahill. Those are just a few off the top of our head, but there's so many. There's so many that inspire this text and also, you know, circulate in reading groups and over coffee among comrades.
Awesome. Well, I just thank you for coming on and talking about this stuff. And, you know, maybe I'll see you in the autonomous territories, you know, with my with a shipment of seaweed from the Atlantic coast.
We'll bring some coffee and
snap
it and pop on.
Excellent.
Don't bring it all.
Awesome. Well, have a great day, y'all, and thanks again.
Yeah,
that's what life does. Sputnik's bones in the satellite hover overhead. Holy dog in the shrine, this is how we treat our gods. Don't get it twisted, we're all nailed to the same cross. Optimism is just a wish with a curse. My homie's working on a probe headed to Jupiter's moon. Maybe they'll find life there, I'm looking for it here. You'll make me nihilist, but I still believe it's one where the fire is, long after it leaves. We want you to work longer and harder and faster. I want to live better and calmer, surrounded by laughter. When I look up, I'm blinded. I look down, I'm blinded too. Nothing to live up to, no one to give up to. Some new friends, and friends no more. Just so you know, I don't want your bloody throne. You ain't no kid, that's just a crown. I don't want your bloody throne. 100 failed states later, swap kings and queens for the mighty dollar. They think we need better politicians. Who are they kidding? Sleepwalking children. I don't meditate, but I probably should. We bought a yacht, but it's for the birds. Gun down downtown, isolated in the burbs. Take what you can, all you deserve is worms in the dirt. I'm just a man, crying into a computer. No violin player, no poet laureate. Describing leaves in autumn, they're red. The future's black, white is the color of death. I don't wanna own that. You wanna rule, at the top you're all alone. I don't want your bloody throne. They promised you riches, but it's riches they stole. I don't want your bloody throne.